Today is the 7th of February 2008, and I'm continuing the interview with Frank Jennings. Frank, welcome back.
Thanks, Barry.
And last time we spoke about Gorton, your time with Gorton, and your return to Queensland, a period of farming up there. And I did send you the previous sessions and suggested you have a listen to them and use this opportunity today to make any corrections, if there was any factual or other corrections or elaborations.
Yeah, right, Barry. Well, I did I did go through the tapes, the CDs, and there are a couple of corrections I would like to make. The first one was on the first CD, where I talked about the 1968 Premier's Conference with John Gorton in the chair, and I said I was sitting at the table with Jeff Yeend as Gorton's senior advisor. Well, that wouldn't have been Jeff at that time, it would have been Len Hewitt.
Okay.
And I think that's a point that ought to be made. Another one on the second CD, where I talked about the Executive Council and when the Governor-General is not available for to chair a meeting, that a meeting could be held with the a minister who was appointed to take charge. Well, that minister was called the Vice President of the Executive Council. There was another correction, an important correction to be made in the fourth CD, and that is that after Holt's funeral in Melbourne, I said that Sir John Bunting, as head of the department, pulled me aside, and because I was arranging the transport of from people in and out of Melbourne for the funeral, and he said that I should. There were five ministers, no two of which should be put on one plane. I mentioned McEwen, McMahon, Gorton and Fairhall and had some hesitation about the other one, and we thought it may have been Fraser, but in fact it wasn't. It was Hasluck, Paul Hasluck. It was the other possible contender for leadership of the Liberal Party after Holt's death. So they're the three corrections that I felt might be made.
Thank you for making them, and I believe there was something you wanted to elaborate on as well.
Well, certainly, in talking about the Holt time, I didn't spend much time in terms of the 1966 election campaign, and that was pretty important because, and pretty hectic in many ways, because it was at the height of the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations. And there are two particular campaign meetings that I think should be referred to give you an indication of some of the feelings about at the time. One was in Melbourne, and I forget just which town hall it was in at the time, but, you know, it was generally town halls that the Prime Minister spoke in, because that was one of the few places where he could get the numbers in, and you did get substantial numbers at these meetings. But one of my first ports of call, if you like, during a campaign was to talk to the officer in charge of the State Special Police Branch, just to see what security issues, if any, they had any intelligence on, to see how rough the meetings might be going to be. And they generally had pretty good intelligence, the special branches of the state police. In Melbourne, the report was that it was going to be a rough meeting, that there were a number of organisations who were prepared to demonstrate pretty violently. So I talked to the PM about that, and we decided that the women wouldn't go. Mrs. Holt wouldn't go, Pat DeLacy, who was the other private secretary, wouldn't go, so that the PM would be accompanied by me as his senior private sec and Tony Eagleton as his press secretary. So we went to this meeting, and the meeting was pretty lively, but it most of the fire was outside the meeting hall with people demonstrating. And when the PM came out and got into his car, they formed a wedge, I don't know what they call it, it's a police technique where they get a wedge around the VIP, and they formed this and got the PM into the car, and I squeezed into the back seat, and then the crowd just pushed against the car. Somehow or other, Tony had got out of the wedge and into the crowd, and the crowd were rocking the car, picking up under the bumper bars and shaking the car. And so I said to, they were getting pretty rough. And so I said to the driver, go. He said, well, we haven't got Tony. I said, Tony will find his own way home. But drive. And then there were people, he said, I'll run over somebody. And I said, well, run over the bastards, but get the PM out of this. And as he started to move, someone threw a sheet covered with red paint or supposedly blood across the windscreen. And this made driving difficult, but I said, go forward, go. And he did, and the crowd sort of parted gradually and the police sort of pushed and pulled people aside. But it was a pretty hairy time. And by the time the PM and I got out of it, you know, we were pouring with sweat, you know, sort of an anxiety. I had no troubles telling the driver didn't want to move because he was going to hit somebody. But the crowds, no one reported any serious damage by being hit by the car, but the car was certainly damaged and scratched pretty severely at the time. And when we got to the hotel where we were staying and the girls were there, or girls, they're all girls, I suppose, Dame Zara would love to be called a girl at that stage. You know, they could see how panicky we were. And where's Tony? Tony's lost in the crowd. But I said, there's no point in going back for him. He'll find his way. And he did, but 10 minutes later or so, a police car came and delivered Tony to the door. But that sort of indicated some of the fire that there was in the election campaign at the time. The next meeting, again, I can't pinpoint which suburb it was in, but it was in Sydney. And we had the same sort of thing. There was most of the demonstration was outside the hall, but there was also a strong contingent of young liberals who to contest the anti-Vietnam sort of feeling. And so the police ran a channel, ran a sort of a pathway for the PM and us. And this time the report wasn't so bad. So we had, Jan Moore was with us as secretary. We didn't have, Dame Zara wasn't there at this time. So again, this channel, we got the PM and me into the car, and Jan was locked out, and the crowd were around the car again rocking the car, and Jan was just outside the door and just couldn't open the door with the crowd pushing against it. So I finished up pulling Jan went the window down and pulled Jan through the window of the car, and Jan wasn't a small girl, so it was quite a sight, but quite a terrifying experience at the time. You know, if you've got to be in a car being rocked by a crowd and a yelling crowd to just appreciate how frightening it can be.
Was that common? Or?
No, they're the only two occasions I came across.
Okay.
in those two particular meetings. But, you know, and the campaign was, those days would have been 5 or 6 weeks. So, you know, it wasn't a regular occurrence, but just in particular suburbs with particular groups that wanted to, you know, make an anti-war point pretty severely. I know at the time, the Melbourne one anyway, with the draped cloth across the car window, I think I remember at the time, one of the newspapers got a pretty good picky of that, which I don't know where I'd get a copy of that, but it would be interesting. Mm. Mm. So I thought that was just a fill in bit that that I didn't mention about my time with Holt.
Good, thank you.
The only other thing about that time that I might have added was after I left Holt, went back to the department that should have been in April 1967, after we'd been to Asia for another goodwill trip, and came back, and I was just walking in King's Hall and just ready to leave King's Hall, and Gough Whitlam and his wife Margaret were coming up the steps, and Gough said, "Margaret, have you met Frank Jennings?" And he introduced me. He said, "Frank's just been, he was working with Menzies and Holt, and he's just going back to the department, but he's been replaced by a Rhodes Scholar, Peter Bailey, an editor emeritus of The Age, Keith Sinclair, and a clerk. So, you know, I think he's done a job here."
Yes, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So that was just interesting. I think the nature of the relationship I had with Gough Whitlam at the time too, which was very, very friendly, and that was great.
Now, you mentioned how after working for Gorton, you ended up finishing up and going farming, as you put it. And then I take it that the next significant occurrence of relevance to Parliament and political events was 1978, working for Ralph Hunt. Is that right?
That's right.
So yes. you went farming for what, about a decade, was it?
Oh, yeah, about 7 or 8 years. Mm. I was farming on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. Mm. I bought a rundown farm there and gradually built it up and got rid of the citrus and the pineapples and went into passion fruit. But I had pecan nuts and a few avocados and things. That was quite an interesting exercise. Eventually divorce beat me there and I had to look for other work. I was interested to, you know, at the time I applied to the, I think there was an employment agency which was run by the Commonwealth Employment Agency or whatever it was called at the
service,
time.
Service, I think it was.
Commonwealth Service.
Employment Service.
Right.
Yes.
And I wrote to those and I gave them my CV I was expecting to be able to get a job in Queensland, like as a farm manager or something like that. And they offered me two jobs, which I think is indicative of how some of the things were working at the time. But the two jobs were, because I'd indicated in my CV that I did a commerce degree and I had 1 year of accountancy, and also that I, in my latter period in Prime Minister's Department, I had acted as Assistant Secretary in the Education and Cultural Affairs branch. The two jobs I was offered, one was in a Catholic school as accountant at a Catholic school, where I'd never qualified as an accountant. The other one was another one in the education system, where I'd, you know, sort of never had any real qualifications at all. So I thought, it looks like I can't. I would have loved to stay in the Sunshine Coast area, a beautiful part of the country, but I then saw that there were some of the ministers were advertising for staff. Peter Nixon, for one, was advertising. And I applied for that. It's interesting. I received a telegram and a ticket to go to Canberra for an interview with Charles Holton, it was at the time, who was head of Nixon's department, which was, I think Peter Nixon must have been in transport at the time. Mm. I was surprised that it was, the telegram says, you know, come down for an interview for this job. And I thought, well, you know, if they're going to fly me down from the Sunshine Coast, I must have a pretty fair chance at that. So I came down and I was surprised. I was interviewed by Charles Holton, who was head of the department, which seemed to be upgrading the interviewing technique a bit to be interviewed by the permanent head. But anyway, I failed that one, that test. He wasn't impressed with my lack of very quick writing skills in terms of trying to answer or provide a reply to a parliamentary question, which I thought was hardly the sort of work you did when you were a private secretary anyway. But anyway, I missed that one. But on the way back to the Sunshine Coast in the plane sort of comes out of Maroochydore, I was sitting next to Nigel Bowen, who was Attorney General. And I'd met him before in my capacity as Secretary of the Executive Council. And as we were coming to Maroochydore, Nigel said, oh, look, fancy, a demonstration here in Maroochydore. There are people there waving a big white sheet and placards. And he said, there's not many people, but, you know, there's 8 or 10 people there, but, you know, what would they be demonstrating about? So we landed and I walked across the tarmac, as you did at Maroochydore, with Nigel Bowen, and here's this great sheet on two poles, and these girls who and their daughters, some of the girls I knew from the Sunshine Coast area, with "Welcome Home, Fat Cat Frank."
Jeez.
They thought I was a certainty to get this job, and I was going to be a fat cat again. But they were disappointed when I said that I'd lost that job. You know, they were having some fun.
Yes.
They were fun people, some of those Sunshine Coast girls. After that, I saw another ad from Ralph Hunt looking for a private secretary rather than a senior private secretary. So I applied for that, and I had as my referees Jim Killen, Doug Anthony, and I think it was Sir Geoffrey Yeend. Pretty substantial referees for that sort of position. And at the time this was after the divorce, and I had to come to Canberra to pick up my three daughters and take them on a holiday. So I'd come down, I hadn't heard about the job. And so I came and took the girls down to the South Coast for a holiday. This must have been back end of January, I guess. And when I was there, I had a message at the caravan park to contact Phil Knox, who was Ralph's senior private secretary. So I rang Phil and he said, Minister wants to want you to come to Canberra for an interview. So I said, you know, fine. So I brought the kids back one day and dropped them around with their mother and had the interview. And Ralph was, and again, this was an interview with Ralph himself, because he said, Phil Knox had not put my name on the shortlist. He'd had 40 or 50 applicants or something, but he hadn't shortlisted my name. And Ralph had asked to look at the rejects. When he saw my referees and my background, he said, why not have a look at Frank? Because Ralph had some trouble with his staff at the time. The private sector had needed replacing and taken a lot of papers home and not posted letters and all that sort of thing. It was administrative nightmare for him. So he was looking for a bit of experience, I think. And the minister himself selected me then, after having talked to Jim Killen and Doug Anthony and so on. And he felt that Phil's not shortlisting me was probably an indication that he might have been a bit insecure having someone with a bit more experience in the field than he had himself. But that was Ralph's judgment. But anyway, I put it out to Ralph. I said, look, I've been farming for 8 years, and I'm not been into paperwork on a daily basis. I said, I have been doing some representations, and I've led a couple of delegations to Doug Anthony and amongst other people in terms of tariff duties and things on passion fruit juice and stuff, and also with some of the state ministers on labelling of products and things like that. But I said, I haven't been into day-to-day paperwork, so I'm rusty. He said, oh, you'll be right. Won't take long. Won't take long for you to run in. So that was great. I left the interview being appointed, virtually. So I went back, finished off my holidays. He said, when are you available? I said, well, holiday with the kids, and I go back, and we fixed a date. And when I came back and wound up all my affairs in Queensland, and again I said, I'm rusty. He said, oh, we'll run you in, you'll be right. And run me in he did, pretty quickly. I spent a bit of time sort of briefing myself on he was Minister for Health at this stage, briefing myself on the department and basic health issues at the time, and I guess within, well, the budgets then were in June, so it would have been probably, I was only there for 2 or 3 months, I suppose, and he threw me in to as his representative on a cabinet committee that was along with Jonathan Gall, who at that stage was, I think he's probably still a lobbyist around town, but Jonathan at that stage was working with the Liberal Party secretariat. So we were the two on this committee with people like, I remember Sir John Carrick was chairman, I think, and Margaret Guilfoyle was on the committee, and it was on the handling of some changes to the Medicare system and how we handle that sort of PR-wise and so on. So that was, to me, that was real deep end sort of introduction to the health portfolio.
This is 1978, is it?
This is 1978, yeah. And it wasn't long after that, although he had a journalist, Bob Lawrence, on the staff as his assistant private secretary, and Bob used to go with him a lot around the electorate and so on, and he was, Gwydir electorate was probably the biggest electorate in New South Wales, and Ralph worked his electorate, very well and very hard. He was a good local member, and each parliamentary break, major break, like the winter break or the summer break, he'd try to get around all the towns in his electorate, or as many as he could, and that was a long, perhaps say 6 weeks exercise. And it wasn't long before he suggested that I look at all the cabinet submissions and so on, and that I handle inquiries that he gets from the media. So this again sort of put more pressure on me to, you know, sort of own up and so on. And I was enjoying it. I was enjoying getting back into harness. Mm-hmm. And Ralph, I found, was often been referred to me as the last of the gentleman politicians, but there are others around, I know, but he was a pure gentleman in terms of the way you handle people and so on. I remember when Bob Hawke was brought to tears in the chamber in Parliament when someone asked a question which referred to one of his children being on drugs, and Bob just cracked up. But the first thing after question time, the first thing that Ralph did said, "Get me Bob Hawke on the phone." So, you know, it didn't matter who it was, which side of the house it came from. He was quite compassionate as far as people were concerned. Actually, in the same sort of area, when this would have been a bit later, when a bit later on, I think, but I can, I think the story fits in here pretty well. One of my sons had a bout of schizophrenia, and I had a phone call from, he stayed up on the Sunshine Coast, and I had a phone call one day from one of his mates saying, you know, Daryl's crook again. So I said to Ralph, look, I got a son in trouble here. He said, don't worry about that. We'll look after things here. You race off and look after your family first. Mm-hmm. And that was the sort of man he was. Mm-hmm. It's not the sort of picture you get of politicians in today's newspapers, but they are there, those sort of people.
Where were you working?
We were working in the new wing, this new East Wing or whatever it is.
Right, of Parliament House.
Of Parliament House. Yes, we had an office which was right now near the back of Parliament there. Yeah.
Had the building changed at all in that time?
Well, that new wing had been added. Mm. And even then, we were horribly cramped. You know, the numbers of staff we had in that area, I mean, health and safety people would be horrified today if they thought you were putting so many people. You know, it was almost as bad as this office here that we started in. It wasn't much better, and we had what? There would have been two, four, there would have been six of us, I guess, on the staff at the time. And I know it was very difficult. Bob Lawrence and I were in one little room, which, now we each had a desk, and we each had three drawer tin cans for our filing. Tin cans, I shouldn't call them tin cans, I suppose. filing cabinets.
Yeah. Did you used to call them tin cans?
I used to call them tin cans because I reckon you give them a good thump and you could spring them open anyway. they weren't real secure. Yeah. But you had these plus our desks. And this would have been a room, I'd say 10 by 8 would have cut it out. And we had the two of us with all our equipment, two phones, and both working on phones a good bit of the day, which is pretty distracting. So they weren't good working conditions. Well, conditions were okay, but they were cramped.
Yep.
And you got interruptions and so on in that sort of manner.
Where were you living?
78. I was living in Downer. When I came back, I lived at Havelock House I lived at Havelock House for about a month or 6 weeks, I suppose, when I came back, when I first started with Ralph. But then that sort of didn't suit me too much. It didn't fit in too well with working odd sort of hours when you couldn't get back to your guest house sort of thing at meal times, and you had to make other arrangements. But then I fairly quickly got a little two bedroom unit in Downer. And looked after myself there, and I didn't mind looking after myself because I always feel that I'm a fairly competent cook, and if I can cook at the weekends and I've got a fridge and a freezer, I can, you know, prepare myself for the week or whatever. So I found that more congenial than one little room in a guest house.
Sure. What about the procedures? Had they changed much in that period you were away?
Not really. The procedures for cabinet were much the same. Security arrangements for cabinet documents were much the same. Although I think they did sort of bring in some tighter control as to who could see cabinet documents and that sort of thing. And then I think, I don't know if it was that stage or a little later, that they started sort of, because of leakages of cabinet documents and things, I think they started some security numbering of, or different technique of numbering, so they could identify which, if they found a copy of a document, they could identify where it came from, at least where it was delivered to, which gave them a better chance of tracking down the source of leaks. I know we were drummed pretty severely about security those days, and I guess people these days are still drummed about the need for security, but there seem to be more and more people quite prepared to breach security and pass material onto journalists these days than they were then. I know I've never had much sympathy for whistleblowers in that sort of sense. I think not in terms of releasing documents and so on. If you're talking about whistleblowing on fraud and things like that, that's something quite different. But handing documents to the media because you don't like a government decision or whatever, to me it's theft for a start. It's not your material, it's government material, whether you prepared it or not.
Yeah.
It's government material, and you've got no right to exercise your right to dispose of that material in a way you see fit by putting it out in the public arena if the minister or the head of the power or your senior officers don't think that's appropriate. Maybe I'm still a bit old-fashioned that way, but
Sometimes the leaks are controlled leaks anyway, aren't they?
Well, that's right. Yes, yes.
So it's reached that new level.
It has. New techniques have come in. New skills, I suppose, have come into the system.
What was your designation with Ralph Hunt?
Initially it was Private Secretary, which was 2OC in the office. Phil Knox would have been Senior Private Secretary. That was so until 1980. I think I was with him for about 2 years. And in that 2 years, in health, let's think, no, in health I didn't travel overseas with Ralph in any health capacity. But he was feeding me more and more of the work which Phil had normally had in terms of, you know, cabinet documentation and parliamentary work, because of my background in sort of Hanney's replies to questions, making sure his briefings for parliamentary questions were okay and all that sort of stuff. now, the briefings were prepared in the department, but it was, you know, one of my roles would have been to see that any of the current issues were covered in the briefing notes.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't preparing the briefing notes, but I was keeping an eye on the media and if anything cropped up in his area that I thought might be raised in Parliament, it was important that the department be asked for a brief and that sort of thing. And I kept that briefing folder sort of thing up to date for him. So gradually these sort of things were coming my way rather than Phil's. When Ralph was appointed Minister for Transport, which was would have been in 1980, must have been in end of May or early June 1980, because the first assignment as Minister for Transport was to fly to Norfolk Island, because the former minister had agreed to go to Norfolk Island to two issues. Well, one issue was they were going to extend the airport to put jet planes could go into Norfolk Island, and the locals were afraid that the jets would damage the stained glass windows in St Barnaby's Church, St Barnabas. St Barnabas? St Barnaby's. Their famous church on Norfolk Island. And the other thing was to represent the government at the at their celebrations for the landing of the Bounty people, way back when the Bounty people from Pitcairn Islands and so on that landed. Bounty Day, they called it. So this was the long weekend in June, and Ralph took me along with him. I remember Rena and Jane McPhillamy came as well as a stenographer, and Ralph and Mim Hunt, his wife, came as well. So I think that was the first trip away I had with him, and that was the beginning of transport. And that was an interesting trip, and we reassured the natives that, not the natives, but the local people, that the jets wouldn't interfere with their beautiful stained glass windows in the church. But there were a couple of other trips after that. There was one to New Zealand for South Pacific Forum of Civil Aviation and Regional Shipping Conference. With representatives of all the South Pacific Islands and New Zealand and so on. And he took me along with him there as well. And then there was a trip to the US, UK and France on transport. I know the France bit was... was when TAA were thinking of getting the first Airbus, and we met Frank Ball in France, who was chairman of TAA at that time, and we went to Toulouse, I think it was, to the plant and saw this magnificent new aircraft type being built. And that was a good exercise, a fun exercise, going through this manufacturing plant and having discussions with the board and so on about the new equipment and things like that. So, all this got a bit too much for Phil Knox, who felt he was being pushed aside, and when we got back, he said that he'd found himself another job. Mm-hmm. In Queensland, I think as director or something of the Law Society, and Ralph immediately appointed me as senior private secretary. Then, So, and that didn't change my functions very much at all, because I was still looking after the parliament in the cabinet and the press and so on. So, yes, I had another trip then with Ralph in, would have been in 81, I think. We again went to America and Britain, and then while we were away, Malcolm Fraser, as PM, sort of asked Ralph to extend his trip to 5 African countries to deliver invitations to the CHOGM meeting, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Melbourne in 82, I think it was. So that again was interesting. We went from wherever we were, probably London or somewhere. I remember we went to Frankfurt for an aircraft change, and I was surprised at the airport to find these troops around the place with submachine guns, and I thought, they're not there to protect us, surely. You know, I don't know what was going on at that stage, but it was a bit frightening to find troops with machine guns sort of prowling around airport lounges. But obviously they had some issue on at the time. But we flew from we flew then to the Seychelles, beautiful island paradise in the Indian Ocean. We had 2 or 3 days in each of these places, about 3 days, I suppose, in each of these countries. We went to the Seychelles, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Zambia, and Malawi. And each of these places, we met the presidents of the country and officially handed over the invitations, formal invitation to attend the meetings in Melbourne. And that in itself was an experience to... we had lunch, for instance, with Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia. And yeah, we lined up for lunch at this long table, and he was at the head of the table, and it was quite strange. As he sat down, 2 attendants came, one with a bowl of water and another one with a towel, and he washed his hands, and he said, "You people can use your knives and forks, but I'll eat traditionally." And he just dived in with his fingers into his, you know, rice and whatever we had. So that was an experience that I didn't expect to see. I remember then in Zimbabwe, for instance, there was an incident in Harare. We were at this hotel in Harare, and Penny Wensley was with us. Penny was at that stage was a middle range officer in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and actually, you know, while we're on this trip, the Public Service Board did a check of permanent heads as to which did they have any women in their department who had the potential to be permanent heads. Now this is what are we up to, 81 was when that sort of issue was building up, and the head of Foreign Affairs at the time might have been Jim Plimsoll, maybe then, I'm too sure, but suggested that Penny was one of those who had the potential to become a permanent head. And I think now she's been our representative at the United Nations. She's been a High Commissioner in New Zealand and a few other places. She'd done very well. But she was with us as a foreign affairs rep of these countries, and you really needed them to get some feel of the country and some of the politics, you know, before you you talk to the officials or the yes. presidents and ministers and so on. And her briefing was invaluable at that time. But I was, you know, it was late evening, I know, as the sun was going down, and Penny and I were just out in the balcony having a bit of a chat, and we heard some bombing and so on and strafing. So there was some aircraft activity not too far away from the capital. But so even at that stage, there were, you know, some problems with rebel groups and so on in Zimbabwe. But certainly not like it is today. The country was, they were full of hope. The ministers were full of hope for the future and building the economy. And actually, Ralph and I had had lunch while we were there with the minister for primary industry, who was a very intelligent lady, we were. One of the problems that she raised was they could grow corn or maize or whatever they called it, and but their problem was storage. They couldn't keep it for long. It would go off, go mouldy, or the insects would get it, weevils and things. So there were times in the year when they were, you know, out of supply. And this was a problem. We thought, you know, that's not a real problem. I mean, we have big silos and things like that, but of course there was the financial thing with big concrete silos and so on and storage facilities. And so Ralph said, well, we'll see what we can do about that. And he said to me, he said, well, when we get back, see what we can do about cheap storage for grain. So I got in touch with CSIRO and I said, it's got to be cheap. And he said, well, I said, that's not a problem. Well, some of these old techniques that our farmers used to use, dig a hole in the ground, put a bit of galvanised iron down, put your grain into the galvanised iron, which protects them from the moisture and stuff, and then cover it over with a, you know, tarp or something, you know. Pretty simple, cheap technique. So we shot this back, you know, hoping it could help solve some of their problems. But these are the little things that you know, here we don't think of, you know, anything about storage of grain, but in those countries, it's some of those simple old farm techniques are valuable.
Yes.
So these are some of the, it's the sort of thing that comes out of some of these visits. I know a lot of Australians criticise ministerial visits overseas, but I've found time and time again that whether it's been with prime ministers or ministers, that you get some of these things happening that are important for the locals. It's not just getting information for yourself that's valuable, or getting support for UN committees and things like that. But if you can provide some basic help, like in this case in Zimbabwe, you've got a better chance of getting their support as well. To me it was we didn't have to be diplomats to be providing some sort of diplomacy service for the government.
Did that happen? Do you know? Did you have any feedback from
Zimbabwe? I had no feedback. No, sent it back through Foreign Affairs, but I had no feedback from it after that.
And with Tanzania, I guess you would have met Nyerere, did you?
Yes, Nyerere, and I don't recall too much of that one, but I do recall the one in Malawi, which was Banda. President Banda, who would have been 88 or 90 or something at the time. And I remember, I'm sorry I lost the note, but I had a note from our Deputy High Commissioner saying, we have a meeting arranged tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Depends how the President feels whether that meeting will go ahead. That's the you couldn't always be sure that the president would be available. He was getting quite erratic at that stage in terms of his behaviour and so on. Anyway, we went along. We had this meeting with the President Banda, but again, it was eye-opening from our perspective. When we arrived, he had two of his ministers with him, joined in the introductions and the discussions. And when they went out, they backed out of the room and then knelt and bowed when they got to the door. There was no way they could turn their back on the president. So, you know, these sort of cultural things were still going on in some countries, which we found a bit hard to understand. But I think it was also in Malawi where when we got to the... because I was in charge of the passports and things for everybody on the group, and I tried to get from the protocol people the passports back, and they wouldn't give them to me. They said, "Oh, they'll be at the airport." So I got to the airport, and I still couldn't get the passports. And anyway, when I did get the passports, there was one missing, and that was mine. And you know, the plane was delayed for an hour or two. And I couldn't understand, but apparently eventually I got mine back. But apparently they thought I was a security risk of some sort. I was a security officer and not just a private secretary. Yeah. And they were making all sorts of checks and things on Frank. So, yeah, that was a bit hairy. Just imagine being kept stranded in Malawi for a while. I think another incident on that trip that wasn't a bad sort of a story. In one of the countries we went to, we stayed at a guest house at a game park, and early in the morning, we went out on a to have a look at some game in a Land Rover with a the driver and this guard with a 303 rifle, and I was in the back of the Land Rover with the guard and so on, and I think Penny was in the back. As we were going, we saw a couple of elephants. Well, we went past a couple of elephants. As we went past, a couple of elephants went across the road, and I jumped out to get. I mean, the sun was right behind them, so I jumped out to get so I could get a photograph. And oh, yeah, horror! Jump back in the car! Don't get out of the car! Don't get out of the car! You know, they might stampede. And there was a daddy elephant and a mummy elephant, little baby trotting on behind. They said, "Oh, and with a baby there, there might be trouble." And jumping into that grass there could be lions there. Oh, they were a bit horrified. So when we finished the day and the minister was signing the guest book, he said, "I've lost a senior private secretary somewhere in the park. If anyone finds him, send him back to Parliament House, Canberra." So he had a sense of humour as well.
And then, so that the purpose of going to the African countries was to formally invite them to attend the Chogham.
That was right. Yeah. That was the reason. I did not say excuse, but.
No,
but it's the only opportunity I've had to visit African countries, and it was really eye opening, and in many ways.
And then you returned to Canberra, did you? From
back to Canberra, from there, straight back to Canberra. So that was an interesting trip.
I'm wondering during that time with Ralph Hunt, did you have much to do with Malcolm Fraser, the Prime Minister?
Oh, certainly with his staff. I found, well, if you're looking at it in the sense of cabinet and handling cabinet documents and cabinet meetings and so on, It seemed that Fraser was, no, what sort of words to put to this, but he was pretty dogmatic and seemed to hold more meetings than necessary to get decisions and put more matters to committees for further consideration than any other Prime Minister that I'd been associated with. For instance, some of this stuff on the changes to the Medicare, it was probably, you know, from the original submission, you might have had, you know, five or six meetings before you got a final decision, whether it be by cabinet or cabinet committee or whatever. I found, and I think this reflects the nature of Fraser the man too, the sort of staff he had and the way the staff, well, the way his staff treated me relative to other ministerial staffers, relative to the way other ministerial staffers treated me, sort of thing. I mean, people like Petro Georgiou one of his senior advisors, and I remember going in there with something, some changes, or some statement the minister proposing to make, and I said, well, this is what the minister wants, and the reaction from Petro was, and he'd be lying back in his desk with his feet up, and just a dictatorial, you know, what's it matter what Hunt thinks? This is the way it's going to be done. And this is what Fraser wants. Well, it was his interpretation of what Fraser wanted. And he was saying, well, you know, who's Hunt? So he was brushing aside this ministerial sort of reaction to things. And it was pretty much the same with David Barnett, who was his senior press officer at the time. And it wasn't for the minister or his department to say what was going to go in a press release. You know, we'll determine that and when it's released and so on. So there was a bit of a dictatorial attitude on the part of his staff, on the part of Fraser's staff. I didn't have much to do with Fraser per se. But I think the staff indicate the nature of the man a lot in these sort of situations, and certainly there are two members of the staff that I, you know, they just weren't interested in what I had to say at all, and I was only saying what my minister wanted to have said, so they were brushing aside relatively junior ministers, as they saw it, and as being unimportant. I thought that wasn't good for the running of a cabinet at the time, but I can understand. I think the figures show pretty clearly that in Fraser's time there were more cabinet and cabinet committee meetings held than under any other prime ministerial chairmanship, and I can't say whether that's because he was indecisive in coming to conclusions on matters, or whether he just wanted to make sure he got things right politically. I'm not sure what reason you'd put to that, but that's for some other analysts to determine, yeah, I think. But I didn't find it easy trying to work with Fraser's staff at the time. And I can't say that about any other minister's staff. Yeah.